The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. May God bless the state of Texas and its honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, court has two original mandamus proceedings on its oral submission docket. In the order of the presentation, they are Bristol Myers Squibb Company and others versus the Honorable John McClellan Marshall, and Ethel Corporation and others versus the Honorable Kathleen Stone. In each matter, we have allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The lector may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We'll take a brief recess in between the presentation of the arguments. These are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a taped copy of the arguments for a nominal fee. Court is ready to hear argument from relators in Bristol Myers versus Marshall.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Young and Mr. David Harris will present argument for relators. Relators have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Young will open with the first 12 minutes.
May it please the court, Rule 174 and the case law under it acknowledge that the trial court has broad discretion in ordering consolidated or separate trials. But that same case law indicates that that discretion is not unlimited and must be exercised in such a way as to protect against the dual risks of jury confusion and prejudice to the parties. The nature of the breast implant litigation makes the potential for that confusion and prejudice from a consolidated trial particularly acute.
Are there different standards we ought to apply in breast implant litigation from other mass tort litigation?
Not in the sense of one law for breast implant cases and another law for other cases. But the standards that this court has laid down and should lay down will apply differently in breast implant cases because of the characteristics of that litigation than they do in other litigation because of the characteristics of that litigation. The rules and principles are the same. The application is different.
We might agree that there's something unique here. Haven't there already been a number of trials that have occurred in Texas that have been consolidated, not unlike this, where they've gone to verdict and there's a history here?
There's a very short history, Your Honor. First of all, to our knowledge, there has never been a multi-plaintiff breast implant trial outside the state of Texas. Within the state of Texas, there has never been a trial of as many as 9 plaintiffs as is proposed here. In fact, the largest number that we're aware of is 4. And we're not aware of any multiple manufacturer trials, certainly outside the context of a woman who has multiple implants with different manufacturers. So we certainly...
How many trials have there been altogether?
There have only been a handful of breast implant trials altogether. While there may be a mass of cases, and there may be a great pretrial management problem for breast implant cases in the state, there are not courts whose trial dockets are languishing because the courts are preoccupied trying breast implant cases. That
what
simply
percentage of all breast implant cases that are pending in state courts across the nation are in Texas courts, approximately?
I do not have that number. The number that I have is that about 10,000 plaintiffs are pending in Texas.
Of course, how many are in the MDL or are circling?
I don't have that number. I do know that we anticipate that as a result of the global settlement, as things stand now, approximately half or more of the Texas cases will be resolved by the global settlement. If that global settlement is in a critical phase, I might add, it's entering a final opt-out period between now and early summer. And by the end of that period, if plaintiffs are not given the false hope that they can beat up on a defendant through a mass trial in Texas, we hope that a large number of women will elect to take those settlements and reduce the caseload accordingly.
My question really wasn't going to judicial efficiency. It was really going to the history experience. It'd be one thing if we were trying to analyze this from a perspective view, but in terms of cases already tried and already held, the real parties argue that the results of that, those cases demonstrate that there's no confusion and none of the things that you're talking about.
I don't think the results demonstrate that at all, Your Honor. First of all, we have a very small sample, and in only one case that I'm aware of do we have a widely disparate result between two commonly tried plaintiffs. That was a case in which the plaintiff who recovered nothing was a nurse, and it may very well have been that the jury reasoned that being a nurse, she was already aware or should have been aware of the risk of breast implantation, and it presents a very different case to say that the jury was able to differentiate between those two plaintiffs, who I might add had the same manufacturer, than they would have in the case of a multiple manufacturer trial involving nine plaintiffs where you don't have a healthcare professional as one of the plaintiffs.
Mr. Young, with the four cases were actually tried, isn't a lot of the what's been written about juror attribution of the strength of one case sort of spilling over into another case really speculative?
Well, we don't know if it is or not. I suppose in that sense you would say, yes, it is. But
we don't know there's really been any harm until after the jury's come back, because they may differentiate between cases.
You won't know until after there has been a track record, and you won't know in an individual case where there is some degree of differentiation. Is that the product of a well-reasoned and non-prejudiced evaluation of the facts, or is it a false attribution or a problem of jury confusion? That's part of our point about why mandamus is appropriate, and this is raised by the Dalbrier Court. This is not something that you can sort out afterwards, except in the very most extreme case where they give a bunch of widely disparate plaintiffs the same amount of money or something like that, and even there, you're not sure what the cause of that was.
How many plaintiffs are too much when they are grouped together all suing one manufacturer alone?
Well, I would say that depends, Your Honor, on some other factors beyond individual number of manufacturers. It depends heavily on implant date. These cases are heavily state-of-the-art dependent, and it would never be appropriate, in our view, to try together two plaintiffs with widely disparate implant dates, because you've got differing issues regarding the state of the manufacturer's knowledge, the state of the industry's knowledge. These are learned intermediary warning cases, so you have issues of what the medical profession knew and what the plaintiff's implanting doctor knew or didn't know.
But all of that information is still going to come into the jury, even if you have a single plaintiff, depending on when they receive their implantation. In other words, the state-of-the-art information is going to come into the record anyway of what other manufacturers knew, of when who knew what, and
well,
so what if you, go ahead.
In a limited sense, that's correct, Your Honor, but we're not going to be presenting the jury with what the industry knew in 1989 in the case of a woman whose implant took place in 1973. And that's the real potential, not only for confusion, but for prejudice. We don't think even the most conscientious juror can evaluate the evolved state of medical knowledge in those later years without applying it to the plaintiff in the earlier years or without engaging in some impermissible inferences. For example, that the fact that the product was improved over time is a recognition by the manufacturer that there was a prior deficiency. And that's a grave concern in these cases.
Is there evidence in the record that shows when there were differentiations between state of art and state of knowledge? You would expect there would be some breaking points along the timeline. Is there evidence in the record that the trial court could have said, well, we can try 79 and 78 cases together, but not?
Well, first of all, in this particular consolidation, the time span runs the gamut. It's about an 18 or 20 year consolidation. In response to your specific question, Your Honor, there is evidence concerning the package inserts for each of the various plaintiffs, and the court can see, and the trial court can see, how those evolved over a period of time. That's the extent of the evidence in the record about the specifics of the evolving state of the art.
What was the basis for this judge to consolidate these cases?
What happened in this case, Your Honor, was that this judge was designated as the coordinating judge for Dallas County. He picked a number of cases, a much larger number than this, something like 22 or 3, of those cases. And we do not know the basis for his selection of those 22 or 3. He merely took all of the cases pending in Dallas and put asterisks by certain of the cases and said these will be the cases that are tried.
Weren't they all in his court?
They were all consolidated in his court as the judge for pretrial purposes, but the cases were actually pending in all of the different Dallas County courts. A couple weeks later, he altered his rulings and gave the parties a chance to, whose cases were filed other than in the 14th court, to opt back to their home courts. And the vast majority, if not all of them, did so. So the cases that are before the court in the proceeding today are all cases now that are pending in the 14th District Court. They are what is left of those 23 or so cases that the respondent selected for trial initially. And we do not have any indication in the record of his reasoning process in selecting those cases.
So at this point in Dallas County, there's no breast implant judge, as it were.
There is a breast implant judge, but the cases in the 14th court are not being engaged in consolidated pretrial with those.
Mr. Young, if Judge Marshall had ordered a consolidated trial on a single issue of causation in these breast implant cases, of all the breast implant cases pending in Dallas County, would you be here?
Yes, we would, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, this court's rule in Eiley v. Hughes that it is impermissible in Texas to try a personal injury case in a bifurcated fashion between liability and damages. And that is what a causation trial would be, is a trial of part of the liability issue, separate and distinct from the jury that's going to be hearing damages.
So Texas courts cannot do what federal courts have done.
That is correct, as an overriding rule of law. Beyond that rule of law, a general causation trial will not work in the breast implant litigation because the most that it would ever determine is that breast implants either are or are not, in the abstract, capable of causing disease. If that is to be a useful finding, it must be differentiated, first of all, among the many, many different types of conditions and syndromes that these plaintiffs claim to be suffering from. This is not a type of litigation where there is a recognized set of symptoms that either is or isn't caused by the product. This is a cluster of symptoms, and unless you're going to ask the jury in the general causation trial, do breast implants cause joint pain? Do breast implants cause female problems? Do breast implants cause each of these nine plaintiffs claim 28 different conditions?
So is your position you can't try two breast implant cases together?
Not categorically so. No, Your Honor, it is not. It is that until we have a track record in Texas of trying breast implant cases and until individual judges have familiarity because they've tried several breast implant cases, we think that one ought to be the norm. We also think that one ought to be the norm and ought to be the maximum where you have different manufacturers, where you have materially different implant dates, where you have materially different implant types. The record shows three major different implant types in this case, and where you have materially different symptomology. Once all of those factors are the same, once we have our track record, it may be possible to try more than one case at a time, but even in that case, we would caution that there's an outer limit based on two factors. One, the jury's sheer ability to assimilate a mass of detail about a large number of people, all of whom are going to have differing causation and differing individual causation and differing damages.
Until that time, it would be an abuse of discretion to try more than one at a time.
We believe so. And the second factor is what is referred to in the Dalbrier case and in some of the medical literature, the problem of false aggregation. If the jury sees a number of women all claiming sickness and all having had breast implants, it may be tempted to infer from the presence of those women that breast implants cause disease. And what is not seen are the large number of women in the general population who have those same symptoms but no breast implants, or the large number of people in the general population who have breast implants but don't have those symptoms. In short, they're getting a skewed epidemiological sample if you have a large number of plaintiffs grouped for trial.
I know your light is on, but I have one more question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Have there been any Dahlberg or Robertson type hearings on the expert witnesses?
There have been. Indeed, there have been some in this case, and that leads into what Mr. Herrick is going to discuss. We believe that the way to manage the breast implant docket in Texas is, first of all, to allow the global settlement to do the best job that it can of whittling down the docket. And second, to encourage proper use of Robinson to whittle these cases down to size, to resolve the cases where there is no genuine issue of scientific causation, and to go from the issue of systemic injury down to the issue of localized injury in as many cases as possible.
I mean, if we don't build it, they won't come.
Well, and beyond that, we think it blinks at reality to think that if we have, at the end of that process, 1,000 cases left, that the lawyers and judges of Texas are going to insist on replowing the same ground 1,000 times in a row to reach what will then be a predictable outcome. We think if judicious selection of representative plaintiffs is made and those cases are fairly tried, they will promote further settlements and the breast implant cases will go away.
Are you aware of a multi-plaintiff breast implant case being tried anywhere in the state except Harris County?
I'm not aware of specifics. Perhaps Mr. Harris can address that, but I believe there have been. I know there's been a two-plaintiff trial in Dallas County.
And are you aware of any that are on appeal?
No, I'm not, Your Honor, but perhaps Mr. Harris.
David Harris, I represent 3M. There have been several Daubert hearings in Dallas County, including in this case where Judge Marshall struck every single one of the plaintiff's causation experts, which indicates why in this particular case a consolidated trial is even more prejudicial, because the main issue in most breast implant cases is whether breast implants are capable of causing disease.
Maybe I misunderstood. You say he struck all of the plaintiff's causation witnesses?
Yes, on September. And there's a June hearing, which is referenced in Volume 24, Tab 4, the July 14th hearing transcript.
How come the case isn't over?
Because they're going forward on local claims, and we have no guarantee.
Local claims?
Local injury claims. Claims that say breast implants didn't cause disease, but breast implants cause scarring, capsular contracture, things of that nature. Also, at the time this mandate was filed, it was immediately after he applied that ruling to co-defendants 3M and Bristol. It was initially obtained as to only Baxter. The mandamus was filed because we have no guarantee that Judge Marshall will not change his ruling at trial, and as plaintiffs chose to call no witnesses at their Daubert hearing, we thought there was a risk at trial that Judge Marshall might reconsider it, and then the ruling goes away. But as it's postured now before this court, general causation is not an issue, which means now you're going to have a trial that involves 9 plaintiffs, and you're only looking at their local injuries, and as our briefing indicates, especially the appendix, which talks about what the plaintiffs have, it's all very different.
I thought part of your argument was the risk of that in a case where the scientific validity of causation was very controversial, perhaps some would say dubious, that there was a risk of juror attribution of causation. But you're saying that's not an issue here because these are all
We're saying that that should not be an issue if what Judge Marshall said on September 5th actually were to occur at the trial of this case. But under Robinson, he can't go ahead and allow those witnesses to testify anyway. In other words, we don't have any guarantee that because he indicated that he's not going to let them testify now, that at trial he, in fact, will not let them testify. So in our briefing, we have addressed the alternative position of what happens if that ruling goes away. But as it's postured there...
You want us to grant a mandamus on the basis of he may change his mind?
No. Because my argument is the mandamus is even more appropriate if he does not change his mind. Although, as you pointed out, we do have the alternative argument that says it's still appropriate if he does not change his mind. As far as other Daubert hearings, there was a recent opinion which came out of a federal court in Oregon after a lengthy 6-month process which included a week of live testimony, which excluded every single one of plaintiff's expert witnesses on the grounds that they could not, among others, there was no statistically significant epidemiology, important term, showing a doubling of the risk of breast implants, which I understand is before this court in the Havner case, a similar issue on the 2.0 as this is Ninth Circuit case, the circuit from which Daubert originated in the Benedictine context. In New York, there was also a similar ruling by Judge Weinstein, who is the author of many of the asbestos consolidation cases at the district court level. We cite those cases on appeal in our briefing. The general causation that witnesses in those cases, every single one of them also excluded. In New York, Judge Weinstein said that we should not have multiple plaintiff trials until he has experience trying single plaintiff local injury cases, at which point an assessment will be made, which is consistent with the Second Circuit repetitive stress injury litigation case, which we cite for this court in our briefing, and that was also an appeal of Judge Weinstein's consolidation ruling.
Let me ask you, for over a decade, with regard to asbestos cases, they have been tried with multiple plaintiffs with a wide range of injury, along with multiple defendants, certainly more than are involved in this case, sometimes up to in excess of 10 defendants. Why should breast implant litigation be treated differently than asbestos litigation?
Two reasons. One is your question, over a decade, breast implant litigation compared to asbestos is in its infancy. Asbestos litigation is much more mature. We have much more experience with it. The second reason is that breast implant litigation is not the same as asbestos litigation. For example, in asbestos litigation, a plaintiff may have been exposed to many, many products from many, many defendants. That ordinarily is not the case in breast implant litigation. We don't have the defense pointing the finger and saying, no, those were my implants, they were your implants. We have medical records and we know which manufacturer made the plaintiff's implants. So in breast implant litigation, unlike asbestos, we could easily segregate these cases by manufacturer. Judge Marshall couldn't do it because he only had these nine cases, these four cases, where in the Dallas County pool, and as it's worked in Harris County with Judge Schneider, now Judge Lloyd, they will go ahead and have all the cases pending in the county, and they will select those plants that are most similar, and they will set them to trial against one manufacturer.
Do you disagree with that process?
3M does not disagree with the process ongoing in Harris County. They tried, or Dallas County, with Judge O'Neill. They tried to find...
You and Mr. Young disagree on that.
No, I did not hear Mr. Young saying he disagreed with that.
I heard him say one ought to be the norm.
And one should be the norm, and one is the norm. There have been more one plaintiff trials.
But you think what's happened in Harris County in terms of consolidated trials is acceptable?
We think it is acceptable both in Harris County and in Dallas County.
Of course, those are only consolidated for pretrial, as I understand it.
And then they will, as a result of the pretrial, they learn a little bit about the plaintiffs, and then they select those plaintiffs that are most similar, and they set them for trial together.
But is that set back in the court, in the judge of the court where it's filed, or does the breast implant special docket judge try the case?
No, Judge Lloyd will send it back to the judge. For example, the trial I was in last January was tried by Judge Wittig, and that was a three-plaintiff trial. I don't think there was any confusion in that case, but all the plaintiffs had fairly similar symptoms. They all had 3M McGann implants. They all had their implants within 1 or 2 years of one another. So all kinds of other company documents from other manufacturers weren't coming in. And that's very different than these nine plaintiffs who were grouped only by the computer filing system that the court spits out to the 14th District Court.
What's the largest number of plaintiffs tried in a breast implant case in Texas?
I believe Baxter had a trial in Dallas County in front of Judge Godbee with either 4 or 5 plaintiffs, and that is the largest outside of Texas, to my knowledge.
Did he also meet the same criteria?
Yeah, I believe Baxter has stated on this record in the context of the July 25th hearing, which is tab 4 in volume 24, that yes, Baxter thought that worked in front of Judge Godbee. In fact, they did not think there was any confusion because, and this is the key, those 4 or 5 plaintiffs were very similar. They were all Baxter defendants, and in some of the subsidiaries, for example, Bristol and Baxter bought companies that made implants, and they made different types of implants. So Baxter and Bristol would be concerned that not only must they be Baxter defendants, but they must be Baxter defendants that made this type of implant as opposed to another subsidiary that they both have to be Baxter defendants because Baxter purchased them. That's not the case with 3M because we only had one company that we purchased that made implants, but that also is a concern.
If we were to write an opinion saying that implant plaintiffs could be tried in groups of more than one, provided that they were tried against a single manufacturer, and provided that all of the women who were grouped together had similar symptoms or similar medical problems, how would we state that in an opinion so that it would be clear for the trial courts to understand the range of symptoms or the range of complaints within which plaintiffs could be grouped for trial?
There would be a couple ways to do it, and let me preface this by saying it might be a little more difficult because the plaintiff's symptoms are so subjective and vague in their efforts to get away from the epidemiology. That said, however, you could segregate plaintiffs by, for example, plaintiffs who claim a classically defined and recognized autoimmune disease, such as scleroderma. If you have three scleroderma plaintiffs, you can put those scleroderma plaintiffs together against a single manufacturer. Then you might find three lupus plaintiffs and put those plaintiffs together against a single manufacturer. You might find three atypical connective tissue disease plaintiffs who actually have some symptoms and send them against the manufacturer. You might find three atypical connective tissue disease plaintiffs who really don't have any symptoms and then send them for trial against the manufacturer. Within the ELK umbrella of atypical connective tissue disease is basically every human ailment known to man, which is anything that someone has they attribute to their breast implants. And this is in the record. This is in the Marcia Angel quote, who's the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine that we quote in our briefing. And what that means is that you can't just write an opinion that says anything that says atypical connective tissue disease is okay to try together, because that runs the gamut. But if it is something that's recognized as just lupus or scleroderma or another classic autoimmune disease, try those together against the same manufacturers, and that would be much less prejudicial than letting the clerk of the Dallas County Courthouse spit these out to one court, and that's how they're tried. That's just as arbitrary as doing it alphabetically, or doing it by the number of letters in the plaintiff's middle name, or doing it by the shoe size of the plaintiff's brother.
You're on our time now.
I have a question.
Should be more concise.
Sorry, Ron.
How many of the, or what percentage of the plaintiffs have had more than one implant?
It is a significant percentage, but it's a relatively small percentage. I would estimate, I would only be estimating, that it's less than 10%, and of that 10%, many of them would have the same type implants, because it's often that they would go to the same surgeon, and the surgeons tended to, not always, but tended to purchase their implants from one manufacturer. So it would be, I think, less than 10%, and in that less than 10%, there would be very few trials where you would have a 3M implant and then Baxter implant, although that happens, and that's confusing, but there's no reason to try to make it happen, as we have here, where we don't need to.
The cases you mentioned that were tried by Judge Godby and Judge Whitty, did those go to verdict?
Yes, they did. Both cases were defense verdicts.
Are there appeals?
I do not know. In the case of Baxter's case, I do know the case I participated in, there was not an appeal.
How many implant cases are pending in Dallas?
Dallas has several thousand implant plaintiffs. I do not know if they have several thousand implant cases.
Is several two or four? Or?
There are 2,000 Australian plaintiffs alone in one case pending before Judge Tyson, who is another judge who has opted out of the consolidated proceeding, along with Judge Goodnallis, with Judge Marshall. The rest of the judges are opted into the consolidated proceeding with Judge O'Neill, and I know that there are at least as many in that consolidated proceeding as there are Australians. It is fair to say that there are more breast implant plaintiffs in Texas than in any other place, and there are probably more in Harris County than in any other county, which is why in Texas we have consolidated proceedings by county, whereas California, New York, New Mexico, Tennessee, Oregon have consolidated proceedings by state.
We also have no procedure for consolidated by state.
That's
a little side point. Yes. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for your time.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please the court, Mr. Sidney Rapton, with an argument for the respondent. Two parties in interest, Cynthia Bailey and others.
May it please the court. It is difficult for me to stand before the court and defend the conduct of Judge John McClellan Marshall. I believe that the court, and particularly in this proceeding, has on many occasions acted arbitrarily, has failed to follow the generally recognized rules applicable to procedures in his court. And I'm not going to dwell on this because there are other issues involved in this case. But Judge Marshall originally signed all of the breast implant cases in his court, plus one case from every other court in Dallas County that he was administering as the pretrial judge for trial 45 days after the entry of his order. Conduct which technically is permitted by both the rules of procedure and the Dallas local rules. Not only did the defendants, also the plaintiffs, told the judge that it was a virtual impossibility for that volume of cases, and that would have involved about something on the order of 60 plaintiffs, to be ready within the 45-day period of time that he had described. The Dallas judges subsequently asked him to, and he did step down as the pretrial judge in Dallas County, and as his last order, he remanded all of the cases to the courts where they originated. We did not, there were still remaining in his court five cases, and he set all of those for trial. What we have left are three cases. Two of those settled at some point in time before this proceeding. And what we have left are three cases that he ordered consolidated. Now, it seems to me that the thing that the court needs to focus on and the...
When you say three cases, is this nine plaintiff cases, one of one case? Is that how you're counting it?
No, I believe it's a six plaintiff case, the Kemp case, and then there is a single plaintiff case, that's Dolores Williams, and then the Bailey case involves two plaintiffs. Now, if the court were to examine the six plaintiff case, the Kemp case, those are six women whose implants, they were implanted between 1974 and 1991. That case involves women who have implants from different manufacturers, all three of the manufacturers. Two of the women in that case have multiple implants from different manufacturers. Now the other two cases, Dolores Williams is a single implant case, it's a Heyer-Schulte case where the implantation was in 1977. Well within the 1974 to 1991 Kemp case parameters. The Bailey case is two plaintiffs who had their implants in 1980 and 1983 respectively. Well within the 1974 to 1991 parameters of the Kemp case.
So you're saying basically if the plaintiff's lawyer joined six or ten plaintiffs.
I'm sorry.
You're saying basically, I take it this is your argument, that if the plaintiff's lawyer joined six or ten plaintiffs together in a single case, you take the beginning and ending date of those implants and then you can lump anything else in with it?
Well, I think you can do that, but the complaints that they're making here all relate to the features of a single case, that single case being the Kemp case. Now, we're not before this court on an issue of whether Judge Marshall should have severed the plaintiffs in that case. There was never a motion filed to sever the plaintiffs in the Kemp case. All we had was a sua sponte order from the court that I, Judge Marshall, am consolidating these three cases. Now, I'm not suggesting to the court that Judge Marshall went through this thought process because I don't believe he did. But I need to point out to the court the features of this litigation that I believe would make a court ruling in this particular case, that is to mandamus this judge to deconsolidate those three cases, as I believe it would be inappropriate, because I think that the problem exists in one case, that one case being the Kemp case, if there is a problem. And there was no motion to sever. So therefore, what the record that this court has to look at is that we got this one case where you've got these plaintiffs together with no motion to sever, so theoretically at least, no opposition has been expressed to that case going to trial by itself. The only opposition has been three cases going to trial together, which is the, but the other two cases consolidated with Kemp don't add anything. Don't create the problems that these defendants complain of.
Couldn't the lesser, I don't know any of the circumstances under the decision not to bring a motion to sever. Maybe it's not a particular problem, maybe it is a particular problem. But should we consider, when there's consolidation, the interests of the parties being consolidated into such a case? Even if we said, well, the rule ought to be that the plaintiffs ought to suffer the same alleged disease. The plaintiffs ought to be substantially the same in time frame. It ought to be just one manufacturer. Could that rule be applied to just the one case, saying it shouldn't be consolidated with another case where there's too broad a range, as an example? You're saying this problem is all in one case, and so anybody could be consolidated, but couldn't we look at, here's one plaintiff we had this year, this defendant, these parties should not be subjected to a broad range of diseases, should not be subjected to a broad range of time of implants, and to put them in that case would subject them to that circumstance.
Well, I don't know how the court would come to those conclusions based upon the record that's before it, that what the court would then be saying is that you've got a multi-plaintiff case and a multi-defendant case, and while there's no complaint about that consolidation, we believe that this case ought not be put in that case, and this case ought not be put in that case. But there are cases in Kemp that are substantially the same as the two cases that were consolidated with it. There are women in the Kemp case who match pretty well the 1977 Hirschulte implant from the Williams case. There are women in the Kemp case who match pretty well the 1980 and 83 implants from the Bailey case.
When you say match pretty well, what are you, can you be more specific?
Well, in a couple of years.
Is that the only factor? That's
same, substantially the same kind of implant. I think there's a fictional notion that that there is a real distinction between implants. The harm is wheel-like. The harm is uniform from one implant as it is from another. The only difference would be, generally speaking, how quickly that harm may befall the woman who has the implant. The other thing that I've, and there's a handout before the court, just to demonstrate the ongoing nature of this controversy and the development of epidemiologic studies, additional scientific studies, in November of 1996, as shown in that handout, the there was identified by a Michigan group in a study sponsored by Dow Corning Corporation that there was a significant odds ratio increase in connective tissue disease, undifferentiated connective tissue disease, among breast implant women.
Where was this published?
It was published in the recent presentation of abstracts at the American College of Rheumatologists meeting in Florida in November. It is an abstract. It will be published in full form whenever it's published. Generally, it takes, with epidemiologic studies, about 9 months for them to go through the publication process. So I would anticipate sometime this year.
Mr. Ratner.
Yes, sir.
Excluding women who have implants from multiple manufacturers, what would be wrong with requiring plaintiffs to be grouped with regard to one aspect, to persons who have received implants from a single manufacturer?
Well, yeah, again, I don't know that this is the place to make that pronouncement or to make that evaluation, because the court would be judging in advance an issue that I don't believe is before it, and certainly with, based upon an inadequate record, that such categorization or putting people together is necessary to prevent prejudice. Now, I would not be candid with the court if I didn't tell the court that that's precisely what we proposed in Dallas. I'm liaison counsel there, and I proposed to the court that the best way to do this is you take the oldest case on your docket, and what you would want to do is look at implant data. And we were talking only about single implant women. The others would be at a future date. And you look to the law firm that filed that case, and you search out all of the other cases that that law firm has on file, and you group around that oldest case those that were closest in implant type, implant date, to the extent that that was possible. In the predecessor to Judge Marshall, that is Judge Andrews, agreed with that process, and we were indeed in the process of implementing that when Judge Andrews couldn't stand it anymore and stepped down, which may be a common occurrence in this litigation, but I don't know. So I don't have any problem with that. I mean, that's sensible. It's logical, but which is not a process that I can attribute to Judge Marshall. I think this was arbitrary. I think that if they had gone through the right complaint, which was to file a motion to sever, which would segregate out the issue.
Mr. Bracken,
yes,
your language leads me to the question, are you conceding that Judge Marshall's order was the result of an arbitrary and capricious decision?
Yes.
Isn't that the first prong of reason to grant a mandamus?
No.
It is not?
No.
And why is it?
Well, frequently judges are wrong. I'm saying this wrong. Frequently judges are right for the wrong reason. Just because a trial judge doesn't think through what he's doing, I don't know.
I took your statement to mean that his decision, the order he entered, was arbitrary and capricious, which is different than his thought process.
No. What I'm saying that the way he got here, got these cases together, I believe to have been arbitrary.
Without, if I understand it, you're saying that your argument might be quite different if the six plaintiff case had been severed out and this and there was an attempt to sever it out and then this same original proceeding had been brought.
Well, I don't know that it would be any different. The because I don't know that we're in a circum. I mean, the question is there a signature disease? Well, the University of Michigan now says there is. Is there a commonality of complaints? I think that all of the literature demonstrates that there is a commonality of complaints of silicone implant women. So I don't know that my argument would, certainly I wouldn't be arguing to the court that there should have been a severance proceeding to properly preserve the error that they're attempting to present to this court to act upon. I obviously wouldn't be doing that. But I, by the same token, I'm not here saying that I think that it's inappropriate to consolidate all of these women. It stretches my view of what ought to be consolidated. I don't think it's in the plaintiff's favor.
We told
Judge Joe Marshall that.
Counsel, how do you answer the argument that this cannot be remedied on appeal?
Well, I don't understand that either. I've participated in the commencement of 3 silicone gel breast implant trials, multiple pointed, and 3 trials in Dallas to conclusion, all of which were multiple implant trials. The
single defendant, single manufacturer?
No. As the case went to trial, and I'll give you an example, there's a case called West Warner Samuelson in Dallas, Bristol Myers case. It involved 1 polyurethane plaintiff and 2 non-polyurethane plaintiffs. We argued to the court that consolidation was indeed appropriate because there is no significant difference between the impact of polyurethane implants and silicone wall, smooth-walled implants. And the court agreed with that, and the cases were set for and started trial. But on the before evidence was put on, the polyurethane case settled, and the 2 smooth wall plaintiffs went to trial. So that is under Bristol Myers' definition of what's a multiple implant manufacturer case. That indeed was a case involving 2 manufacturers.
Would you speak to the issue of all your causation expert being stricken? Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, it's...
Do you put forth this Michigan study indication to us that this is going to be your causation experts?
No. I submitted that to the court in an effort to demonstrate that there is currently recognized a signature disease associated with silicone products.
Where does that leave us with regards to the issue? Causation?
Well, I don't know what Judge Marshall is going to do. I understand that the motion to disqualify our experts was filed Friday afternoon. We did not know of it until Saturday. That is, that a motion had been filed. We also found out on Saturday that Judge Marshall had set that disqualification hearing for Monday.
Is that this week or when was
it? No, that was in August.
In August.
July. It was filed on Friday, heard by him on Monday before we had any opportunity to present our version of the testimony of the experts who were sought to be disqualified. Now, he subsequently granted us the opportunity to file. And we did file a motion for reconsideration, at the start of which he advised us he had no intention of changing his decision. Worse than that, and maybe we'll end up with before the court on some future date with regard to some of these issues, but worse than that, he disregarded the filing of the silicone gel breast implant class action and said limitations were never told.
Does Judge Marshall need another attorney here?
Probably. I wish he was here. Maybe he could explain that ruling to the court.
You mentioned earlier that in some instances you thought that consolidation did not favor the plaintiffs.
Sure.
And I take it if you thought that, you'd be opposed to it.
Sure.
Should it nevertheless go forward, even if it infringes upon individual plaintiffs' rights, in an effort to move things along?
Well, somebody has to complain. One thing about the judicial system, it just rolls along until somebody complains. And that's kind of like where this case is. Nobody has tried to insert the cog in the wheel that would call upon a real review of the conduct of the judge from whose court the case came.
Do you have any expert witnesses at this point?
No. And interestingly, again, I'm just, they filed a motion. Mr. Myers filed their motion. They didn't seek to disqualify all our experts. Their sole motion was to not permit our experts to testify that silicone gel breast implants cause this disease. That was their motion. He struck all of our experts, our chemists, our pathologists, all of which are people who testify about things other than the actual disease itself. They talk about silicone migration, the capsular formations, those things. So the answer is, I don't know how, I don't know how we're going to prove either systemic injury or localized injury.
It's going to be a short trial, I guess.
Yeah, and that's fine. I've had short trials.
And presumably there would be an appeal.
I would hope so. But that's, again, we tried to evaluate whether there was any, quote, profit in trying to get the court to focus on that issue in a mandamus proceeding, or the limitation issue in a mandamus proceeding. And that, I've been practicing law a long time and been, of course, I clerked on this court. But before it was here, a lot of years ago. I didn't feel like that it would be an embarrassment to me to be before this court arguing that it ought to be in a mandamus proceeding ruling on evidence issues or issues relating to the statute of limitations that did not dispose completely of the case. I mean, the rules just, rules are the rules.
Counsel, I know you don't practice full-time in Dallas, but I'm just curious, if the administrative judge there practice a laissez-faire attitude towards individual judges who don't want to have a pretrial consolidation?
I don't know of any plaintiff who doesn't want pretrial consolidation.
Well, I'm just, in Houston, which is where most of the other cases are, it seems like there's always one judge who handles all the matters pretrial, when so designated by the administrative judge.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to hear that there are three courts that have opted out in Dallas.
I don't understand that, but I practice mainly in Houston. In Dallas, what we do is we handle silicone gel breast implant fees with a very limited other kind of practice up there. So, yes, I'm familiar with what goes on in Houston. I'd love it if this court were to order that it's more appropriate for one judge to be handling the pretrial matters. all of the pretrial matters. I don't know that you can do that, but I would certainly ask you to do it if you can.
Oh, I want to go back to an earlier comment you made where I think you said it would be perhaps in your best interest or the best interest of the plaintiff to have the trial of only one plaintiff at a time.
Oh, no.
Okay, I misunderstood you. I thought you said that it would be better to have only one plaintiff at a time go to trial.
No. No, what I said, I believe, Your Honor, was that there is an accumulation of a number of women where I have a personal belief that a jury can lose track. Now, whether that number is 4, 5, or 6, I don't know. But I can tell the court that I believe that putting more than 6 women together in a trial is not helpful, either from plaintiff's standpoint or the defendant's standpoint.
What is a good number of plaintiffs?
4.
Why 4 as opposed to 5? Or as opposed to 3? I mean, what's matching 4? Is it just your opinion?
Well, sure. I mean, I've tried a lot of these cases. I've talked to a lot of jurors. None of them have ever had any difficulty in keeping track of plaintiffs. So that's one thing I think of. The other thing I think of is that I know that in asbestos cases, when you, although I've never tried one, that when you talk to the jury in fact has had some problem in keeping the plaintiffs straight where you have 10 plaintiffs. I mean, it's not, I don't think that real confusion has ever been demonstrated. But if I've got 4 or 5 or 6 good plaintiffs, I don't want them consolidated with a topless dancer. I don't want them consolidated with someone who is going to bring a real negative to my presentation of the case, even though that person's my client, each in his own time, as it were. But no, I think that the cost, like it costs $100,000 to $250,000 to try one of these cases for a plaintiff.
Would that be even if plaintiffs were grouped together, 4 plaintiffs in one trial, would you multiply that figure times 4?
Oh, no. No, no. I mean, we've done some estimates and demonstrated, I believe, that each single additional plaintiff after 3 adds about, after 2, adds about 3 days each to the trial. That is to put in that person's individual complaints. But the general liability testimony, which is the bulk of the trial, is the same. Same witnesses, same issues.
Just to clarify, you said there, it costs how much for the plaintiff to try one of these cases?
$100,000 to $250,000.
And that's with how many plaintiffs? One plaintiff? Or is there any?
We spent the lesser amount with 2 plaintiffs, but those were 2 topless dancers. And the greater sum was with respect to 3 Dow Corning clients whose cases we tried in 1995.
There was a statement made that all cases have been tried have been verdicts for the defendant. Is that true?
I'm sorry?
Not all breast implant cases have resulted in verdicts for the defendant?
No, but it's about half and half.
Oh, I know a big one in Houston, but it got reversed. That's all right. Bob Will.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I have a couple of points I'd like to make. I'm not going to deal, court please, with the Robinson issue because I think that's rather far field to what we're talking about today. Suffice it to say that the Robinson motions were broader than have been described, and the process of their disposition was not quite as it has been described.
Well, it's only relevant to us if it appears that it's a directed verdict case.
Well,
at this stage of the order, then we have other things to deal with.
Again, first of all, I would emphasize what the court emphasized in CSR, is this is recurring litigation, and it is a problem that is rising again and again. We have a judge in Dallas County who is purporting to set 500 plaintiffs all for trial on the same day. So if the court doesn't deal with it today, it's going to be faced with the issue sooner or later.
How about counsel's argument that procedurally there's no grounds for this mandamus because of the consolidation of three cases is not the real harm?
That is a point that one of the points I wanted to address. Judge Andrews, as coordinating judge, issued a blanket order that all plaintiffs were deemed severed from one another, and that he would then group plaintiffs for trial. So when the cases entered Judge Marshall's court, even though they were grouped under a docket number, they were deemed to be separate cases subject to...
Is that order in our record?
No, it is not, Your Honor. But the point that's being made is that we failed to preserve the point that we're arguing here today, and so I believe it would have been incumbent on Mr. Rapkin to produce the record necessary to establish that point. Additionally, and I might add...
Has that order ever been revoked or modified by any judge subsequently?
Except insofar as Judge Marshall modified it by what he did that we're challenging in this case, no, it is not. And perhaps likewise by what Judge Canales has done in setting 500 cases, and Judge Tyson has also set multiple cases. But beyond that, Your Honor, I might add there's a similar deemed severance in the Harris County cases by the pretrial judge. Beyond that, I might add, if you look at the moving papers, while they may be styled as objections to consolidation or as motions to reconsider consolidation, in fact, the relief that they seek is each of these nine plaintiffs being tried separately. And so whether those are perhaps misnamed or otherwise, the point was amply made to the respondent that what was being sought was individual trials. And our position overall is that how the cases are grouped by the plaintiff when filing, which docket numbers they're under, is really of virtually no relevance to the question of which plaintiffs should actually be tried, except that it does make sense to consider cases filed by the same plaintiff's law firm for that fact. I'd like to speak about what we are asking this court to do. We believe that the overall guidelines ought to be those laid down in the Lone Star Ford versus McCormick case, that trial of multiple plaintiffs should occur only when the actions relate to the substantially the same transaction, occurrence, subject matter, or question, and are so related that the evidence presented will be material, relevant, and admissible in each case, in substantial part. We think, however, if the court stops there, then it is going to be faced with a flood of mandamus actions as the trial courts attempt to apply that rather broad standard in breast implant litigation. And so we would urge the court to lay down guidelines for the exercise of discretion under that standard. We believe that except in the case of a plaintiff who has received multiple implants from different manufacturers, it would be an abuse of discretion to try manufacturers together for a number of reasons, principal among which is the fact that these cases involve large numbers of internal manufacturer documents which are admitted against one manufacturer as admissions against interest, but which cannot effectively...
Your time has expired, and I'd ask you to go ahead and give the additional factors, but do it without any argument.
I will do that, John. The other factors would be the implant dates for the reasons that I discussed, the implant types, and we do believe there's a difference between poly and smooth wall. Particular, and common symptomology, duration of implant, and other similar factors. And we agree with Mr. Rapkin, no more than a finite number, and we would add no more than one until the courts have built a track record.
Any other?
That is our position.
Questions? Thank you, Commissioner. I complete the argument in the first
round. May I add something?
You may.
There is no order of severance that was entered in Dallas. We would invite the defendant to file such an order with the court if such an order exists and it does not.
Well, the court is always happy to receive supplemental briefs or motions for supplemental filing.
That concludes argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.